This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Dr. Rhys Halter, environmental biologist and our earth doctor on the program. Rhys, you love all insects.
Of course I do, because they are all part of the system. And here's in a bigger picture. The strength of our forests, the strength of the outback, the strength of all of the places that some of us like to go and look at the stars at night on our back, they depend upon all of the animals and the insects being there, Trevor. When we lose insects, and we're losing a lot of insects, it's actually a disaster, it has a knock-on effect that is shocking. For instance, the birds rely on the insects to eat. No food, no birds. And we're missing a lot of birds, Trev.
The thing is, though, we're aware of, because we've told us many times about bees, and actually just kind of, and I'll go back to bees, because there were a whole lot of bees that I saw yesterday when I was coming back from playing golf and I was pushing my little trolley along, and there are a whole stack of bees walking along the path.
Yeah, that's not a good thing. They're on their last leg.
Oh, well, they would have been. I saw at least 20.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. One is that as summer winds down, the bees naturally, that's the end of their cycle, right? So and when a bee is walking as opposed to flying, not a good thing. They're basically looking for a place to close their eyes and call it a day.
Oh,
forever.
A bit sad now.
Yeah, well, sorry, mate.
No.
But I mean, the best thing, here's what I do, is I gently put my hand on the ground, allow them to come onto my fingers, and then I just put them in the underbrush so that they can go to their next life quietly, as opposed to somebody stepping on them or a cart rolling over them.
Well,
but,
I remember.
You know, that's... Yeah, and that's it. So, but we're missing all these insects, and it's very human of us to say, well, why, right? So, and we want to know one reason. We always want to know that one reason.
Yeah.
In nature, there's a combination of things happening. One thing we're very concerned of are the flicks from the temperatures going very high to very low. This is a big problem, because all life is regulated by temperature, and we know when it's super hot, we're sweating and we need water, and so do the insects. And when it's cold, it's sometimes too cold to even move, and that's not good for them. And our seasons, Trevor, are changing. Everything seems to be moving. It's attenuated. So autumn or summer's lasting longer, autumn's lasting longer, and everything is getting mixed up, and that's confusing the insects, because the insects have to time their life cycle on the plants. And by the way, our friends the bees and butterflies are the main pollinators for over 80 or 85% of plants. That's 336,000 plants on our planet that depend on the insects, the pollinators, the bees, to be alive. And the bee numbers are still falling. We're even now seeing a new bee disease called Shank's brood pathogen that started in Queensland, and we found it in Sydney, and it's bothering our stingless bees. It's killing our stingless bees. So we're worried.
Rhys, things like, because people don't like ants very much because they get in the way of our picnic baskets and they invade our houses. Flies aren't particularly popular, but aren't they important because they break down matter?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, full marks, Trevor. The insects are part of that basic pyramid of the producers, the plants, the consumers, us and others, and the decomposers on the bottom of the pyramid. That's the insects. So they're taking all the living matter and converting it into nutrients for the soil. And they're very, very, very important. Ants are crucial in that department. And and their numbers are falling. As a matter of fact, oddly enough, ants are becoming very marginalized. And what I mean by that is their size is diminishing, as well as their numbers. And that, too, is a big concern because the plants and the soil need to eat, Trevor. I mean, that's where our food comes from, right? From the soil. So we got to take, as all the farmers know, we take care of the soils and we get good crops.
We'll talk to some. We're going to talk to people about their favourite and least favourite insects, but we'll try and stick up for the least favourite ones if there's not a lot of love for them. Tracy, good morning.
Sorry, I was giggling about. Was he Canadian or American?
Hey, Reese, he's a bit of everything, really. He's a bit of Australian as well.
I'm a bitzer. I'm a bitzer. There's no question of that.
Oh, he's still on the line. Look out. So, I'm worried about the fruit fly in Tasmania.
Oh, now this is the fact that they're in Tasmania.
Right. That, now, this is a big topic lately.
That's a huge topic because Tasmania is fruit fly free and it's important for their export and their fruit market.
Exactly. Have you still got Reese on the line?
Yeah.
I do. No, no, and that's all the reason.
Here he goes. Here he goes.
The fruit fly is a problem, and that's why you're not supposed to take fruit from the mainland into Tassie, and these are introduced insects. So, and the fruit flies are global, sadly, and we hope that they don't take off in Tassie, the apple state.
But the thing is, though, Reese, because there are going to be farmers that will say, and you can't have fruit fly, but fruit fly would obviously have their purpose as well because they break down fruit.
Yeah.
Other matter as well.
It's true. It's true. It's just that the thing with introduced anythings like rabbits or cane toads, for instance, or foxes, is when you bring them into an area that hasn't evolved with that, there's no natural check on it, right? So there's no particular bird or other insect that can parasitize them really quickly now. And generally what happens, like the rabbits, you may have noticed, their populations bulge super high, and in the meantime, they destroy vegetation that hasn't really evolved to contend with them. So it's a dance.
So it's not the fruit fly's fault. It's the fact that the environmental or where they've been introduced, they've introduced it into places where there's nothing that can then balance the fruit flies out.
Too right. It's a human thing. I mean, they're introduced because somebody brings them over. It's the fruit flies don't own jets. They can't. although, interestingly, New Zealand has some problems every once in a while because some of our Aussie insects, Trevor, get sucked up in the jet stream. And they actually wind up deposited over across the Tasman Sea into New Zealand, where they run amok.
So they hitch a ride.
They hitch a ride.
Rob, good morning.
Hey.
Yes, Rob.
Yeah, Rob. Yeah, Rob is just calling, saying, like one of my favourite insects is the praying mantis.
It comes
in so many different formats.
Yeah.
And it's extremely friendly. I have an affinity with insects anyway, but I live in Far North Queensland, and the thing is that the fruit fly in Far North Queensland is basically, it's an endemic species of fruit fly because it's so close to, you know, Asia and everything else. So that's where you get your Queensland fruit fly, and that's the big concern when you ship fruit.
Oh, it's a huge issue, and thank you. I love praying mantises, Reese. I've never been like that big on picking them up, but the great thing about praying mantises and the varying thing is the different sizes of them.
Yeah, look how they camouflage into their environment. They're stellar, and I love looking at their eyes. They're super predators, and any child, almost any child, Trevor, just their tongues wag when they see them. They go, oh, cool, and they put their little hand out. And
do you reckon that, like I guess for many insects as well, but praying mantis would be the problems they would have is also loss of environment?
Yeah, that's the other thing. Good point. Then the other thing for the insects and all animals is the habitat destruction, right? And I think, you know, this gets at the core, and I know we're going to get some callers on this, but this gets at the core of us, all of us. We are all one. Wherever we live, not just in Australia, but on planet Earth, because we only have one home. Trevor, the only way 7.6 billion procreating humans can make a go is to take less. And I know that's contrary to everything that we've been programmed. Many people in America, perhaps most, when they get sad, they go shopping. And when they go shopping, there's a lot of waste, and it doesn't make them happier. It's ridiculous. But all of this stuff is killing our planet. I know people don't want to hear that, but it is. And as a result, the animals and the insects can't make a go because in order to get the stuff, we have to consume more of nature.
But that whole idea of balance, sometimes we don't recognize because we're sort of now become the apex predator for no other reason than we have a thumb and we have opposing, and we can do all of these things compared to other animals. And that's really the only other reason. That we have a belief that we're more entitled to the planet than any other species. And so really we need to recognize that our place is just as important as anyone else's place.
Yeah, and I'll put it to you this way. It turns out even more that we actually depend on everything else and that the loss of everything else is ultimately the loss, not just for you and I, but our entire race.
And
so in other words, we got to act collectively here.
I think we're starting to learn that more and more, though. I think that as members of the planet, we're recognizing that we should appreciate other species more than perhaps only looking at ourselves.
True. We just need to embrace it even more. And I think, I mean, it boils down to one thing, in my humble opinion. I think it boils down to this. We need to award people for being thrifty, not profligate or wasteful, right? And being thrifty is cool. It's like the trees are thrifty. There's no waste in nature. There's no unemployment in nature. And everything in nature depends on everything else. It's a flawless model that I wish, honest to goodness, that all of us could really put both arms around and give it a big old hug.
Good morning, Bruce.
Hi.
Yes, Bruce.
I've been in the eastern Sydney and I've noticed a reduction, of course, in bees. Occasionally we see a bee with a very short abdomen. We know, I think that's the natural bee, or native, I mean. And cockroaches, the flying cockroach that bothers us mostly in February, hardly seen any. And Christmas beetles just about disappeared. Now, I'd like to ask your guest, do you think it's like DDT was to weakening eggshells? Is there something out there that's doing it?
We just heard about insecticides and whether or not insecticides have got a huge role to play.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do, Trevor. There's one class of insecticides called neonicotinoids. The neonicotinoids are a systemic poison. There's more than 1,000 kinds on the marketplace worldwide. The seeds are dunked in the poison, Trevor. As they imbibe their first water, the plant recognizes that it's a poison. And it stores it in a large cell called the vacuole cell. The plant separates the poison from itself, and it pushes the poison forth in its leaves to dissuade the insects from eating it, and also through its flowers. The problem with the neonicotinoids is not just that they massively kill what we call non-target insects, like our bees, for instance. When the bees come in contact with these poisons, they lose their minds and they shake to death. Then, when the flowers dehiss or fall onto the ground, the poison is spread into the soils. It kills the soil organisms, which means that the ground feeding birds have no food. And the ripple effect of that is the goshawks that prey on the ground feeding birds, their numbers have tumbled. And the end point is, without these avian predators, the goshawks and others, the vermin, mice and other rats and other little critters that we don't much like that eat our crops, their populations explode.
Which is a really good example of how then the requirement of everyone in the, which we all had the biology books, which was the circle of life.
Yeah,
which is really right. That there is, that's where the circle, if you break down one part of the circle in an ecology and an environment, then it's going to have a flow-on effect.
Yeah, and also these poisons hang around in the waterways in Western Canada. One of my colleagues at the University of Saskatchewan has found that 80+% of all the waterways that she's tested have these neonicotinoids in the water. The bigger question is, are we losing insects globally because of a DDT situation? For the listeners that may be a little too young, in the 1950s, 40s, and 50s in America, we apparently, before I was a twinkle in anybody's eye, we used DDT like it was water, and we put it everywhere. And what we noticed, the scientists of the day, particularly my hero Rachel Carson, who wrote a seminal book called Silent Spring, that the egg shells, particularly on the eagles, but certainly just not the eagles, the egg shells were soft, and the eagle population crashed around the United States. And so we banned DDT. Problem, Trevor, this is a big problem. In inorganic chemistry, that's chemistry that doesn't include the carbon molecule, which would be all our poisons, they are persistent. What's that mean? Well, it means that DDT, PCBs, insecticides, phthalates, biphenyls, and the list goes on and on. They last. How long? Thousands of years. How bad is it, Trevor, you might ask? The green turtles on the Great Barrier Reef that have been tested have hundreds of thousands of persistent organic pollutants in their bloodstreams. This thing has gone global. We are, our use of persistent organic pollutants, these insecticides and others, the stick, by the way, the stuff on our pans, the non-stickum stuff, is terrible. It's in our carpets, it's on our sofas. The dolphins at the mouth of the Swan River in Perth and the Adelaide River are the most contaminated animals on planet Earth with these non-stickum chemicals. We got to back away from this as fast as possible, Trev.
Owen joins us. Good morning, Owen.
Yes, good morning, Ted and Ruth. I originally had three points. I've cut them down to two. One of the things that intrigued me when I was young, this is my first point, was about the fireflies. And when we went to Malaysia on holiday, there's an area where you can go around at night. It's sort of like you go about and you go on the river and you sail along the river, and there'll just be all these fireflies that come into sight at night, and it's really, really, really beautiful. It's one of the it highlights, one of the tourist attractions in Malaysia, so that was really beautiful.
Hmm.
But the second thing I wanted to highlight is, I think it's good when at an early age you get a teacher who is particularly passionate about caring for even the smallest insects. I remember when I was young, when I was about 9 or 10, I was at school and some of my friends, a few of my friends, not me, I must emphasize, a few of my friends killed this butterfly, you know, just thought they had scored or something. And my teacher was furious. He lined them up in front of the classroom and he tore strips off them. He said, You have no right to hurt that. It was doing nothing to you. You know, you shouldn't hurt innocent creatures like that. And he really nailed his point hard. And I think that was really good that from a young age he instilled a sense of compassion for even the smallest creatures, you know.
Yeah, it's a good point on, and it comes down to, Reese, the whole idea of education. And now we see a lot more environmental science education within the schooling system, and and kids learning a greater appreciation of the environment and where we sit.
Yeah, we are, and I commend the millions of school teachers around our planet that help their students by showing them how to grow food, Trevor. One of the great things at so many schools on all of the continents today, because, by the way, a little known fact, 800 million people that live in cities grow their own food. How good is that? A raised box. The teachers show the students how to make soil, how to add material to create soil, to enrich the soil, how to grow food. And we know, Trevor, when we do that, you're going to like this. When we do that, all of a sudden, the bees, our friends, the bees come in, and children understand right from the get-go how important the pollinators are, because some 8 weeks or less later, they have food. So if you can grow your own food, you've taken your power back and also your health.
I've got a text here. It says, Trev, humans serve no purpose on this planet. Nothing depends on us. All the other critters work together to benefit their existence. But all we do is lay waste to all we survey. We need to bugger off the planet. We have to respect for our planet. And also respect the species and respect the things that grace this earth. Ignore human nature at our own peril, because she will fight back. And then off the back of that, enjoy the day.
Well, there you go. Well, I think all of us, Trevor, a good dose of humility, a good dose of kindness for everything and for everybody else. And somebody said to me, oh, but why? You know why? Because it's the right thing to do. That's all. It's the right thing to do good acts for everything and everybody.
David, good morning.
Good morning, Trevor and Reese. Yeah, I just wanted to say my favourite insect, well, not favourite, is a spider. I cannot stand them.
It's not really an insect, though, is it?
Well,
we'll call it a creepy crawly.
Creepy crawly. If they were extinct, I wouldn't, in Australia, I wouldn't be too upset, but that's not the right attitude, I suppose. But what I did want to ask is, I did see a program where they were saying, yes, there's insects going extinct, but there's also new ones being discovered regularly.
Yeah, this is interesting because, I mean, that doesn't affect the decline that we have in other insects, but that's, I guess, the expertise of the entomologists out there, recent discovering the new insects.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's the wonder. And, you know, to be very truthful, and again, I'm probably going to cheese off a number of people, minus the vegans, of course, but looking for new life, exactly why is it that we're going beyond Earth? Right? I mean, yes, there could be something for us. And by the way, it costs a lot of money. Why don't we spend that on our planet? And also, if it's just about do-re-mi dollars, there's an entire industry on cleaning up our planet, making money and jobs. It's as easy as that.
Going to do a program soon. There's a new initiative being put forward, and I think it's by the surfing community or by a community, where there's a thing called Three for the Sea, where people are encouraged.
Three for the Sea, those are my friends. Yes.
Oh, really? Three for the Sea, which I discovered online the other day, where people are encouraged to, every time you go to the ocean or go to the beach, then pick up three bits of plastic.
Yeah, and on Saturday we have hashtag Saturday Plastic Patrol, and wherever you are on planet Earth, you pick up a three pieces of plastic, take a picture, post online with hashtag Saturday Plastic Patrol.
We'll talk about Three for the Sea another day. I've got a text here that says, if Reese is, let me see, where is it? I noticed that, If Reese doesn't like imported things like rabbits, please ask him why he likes imported European bees, which they use in aviaries.
Good question. First of all, I love all creatures. I was simply using the example of rabbits that were brought onto the Australian continent. They did not evolve there. The Clydesdale, the Italian honeybee that has gone global, 1.4 trillion at any one moment in time on our planet. The hardest working girls are working so that we can eat. The listener is right. They don't belong in the Australian continent. And the $64,000 question is, could the Australian continent and its 24 million inhabitants, humans, make a go? And the answer is yes, because there's 1,600 native species of bees, and they actually do the lion's share of pollinating, even on our monoculture crop fields. So you're right. The listener is right. We've gone to the honeybee that perhaps we don't really need to, except for the amount of honey that we take from the girls. It's a big industry. It's an enormous export industry for Australia, and many of our beverages and our sauces and our cakes and breads have that honey in it. So we've kind of waltzed into this dance, Trevor.
The thing, though, Reese, is that do they compete with our native bees, and have they caused a decline in numbers of our native bees?
So far as we understand, on a global basis, yes. On a continental basis, there's not a lot of data to suggest that. Although, having said that, the North American bumblebee was introduced to Tasmania. Touch wood, it has not made the continent. But in Tasmania, there is research that shows that the big bumblebee, the Clydesdale of the bee world, is nudging the native bees away from the plants, and so is harming the native bees by taking their food away.
But they're not the ones that are involved with apiarists. That's not the sort of bees that they use.
No, they aren't. The apiarists, the white boxes, are the European honeybee that is gone global.
John, good morning.
Yeah, thanks, Trev. Reese, a couple of weeks ago, we were up in the Kosciuszko National Park in a couple of areas that we've been frequenting for probably 20 or 30 years, and they're fairly isolated. And this last trip, I was dismayed to find those areas were infested with European wasps, like to the point that I wouldn't bother going back. They were over the vehicle. When you were trying to eat, they were over what you were trying to eat, and I just was dismayed. And I wondered what the ramifications of that is, and, well, obviously not much can be done about it, but where it was headed.
Yeah, and they get in your beer.
Yeah,
they get in everything.
Yeah, they get in everything. They're irascible, to say the least. The fact that they've exploded in the high country is tragic. It again highlights the climate instability. They should not be there. They are parasitic, so wherever they are, they're going to be eating some other insect. In small locations, that's not so bad. In a broad brush where they were, not good. By the way, the way to get rid of them would be, speaking of the bee, is to introduce or place a European honey box, one of those white boxes. When the European bees come in, the wasps take off.
Really?
Yeah. It's a pecking order.
I thought that European wasps were way scarier than bees.
Well, they may be, but they back off. When the European bees are there, they skedaddle, those wasps.
Good morning, Milton.
Good morning, Trev, and good morning, Reese. I've got two insects that I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
One's a lucan flea and a rustican bug.
I've never heard of them.
They can get through the fly screens and get in bed with you.
Oh, well, you don't need that.
And Yeah, and the lucent flea or jacet bites you in bed. No, they're a nuisance. And I've got a favourite bug, and the favourite bug is an assassin bug.
Yeah.
And he's got a nice proboscis that he goes around and gets the heliosis grub and sucks out the juice out of a heliosis bug, which causes quite a bit of trouble with a spray that we use here now. It's a biological, and we've seen the increase in the rough licking bark, so it's been good.
Look, thank you, because I've got another text here. Someone says, the insects I don't like are flies, mosquitoes and cockroaches. My favourite ones are the ones that eat them. Rhys, that's the other thing, is that there's a whole cycle within the insect world as well.
Absolutely, and that's, again, when certain insects are missing or gone, then the ripple effect within the insect world happens. And this is likely why we're seeing this. And by the way, this whole concern of the insect decline happened with a study that showed in Germany last year, maybe three quarters of the way through the year, that over a 27-year period, that on average, 76% of all the insects in the study area were gone, and during the summer, it was as high as 82%. So it is concerning, because the insects are very much part of our planet, whether we like it or not. Some are friendly, some aren't, but we still need them. It would be analogous to, Trevor, you and I taking apart our car and me putting it back together and saying, Trev, I've got 14 extra pieces, but don't worry, your car runs. Of course, when you're ripping down the motorway at 110 or 115, keeping within the limits, of course, that's when one of those parts probably would matter. Yeah.
When you take a look at that, but all of our insects also would be seasonally dependent, of which you talked about earlier. But there would be some seasons naturally that there'd be an increase in numbers, and some seasons that there wouldn't be, on a yearly basis, in that if there's more rain one year, then you're likely to see more insects of one type, and if there's less, you're likely to see more insects of another.
Yeah. Yeah, well, too right. There's a boom-bust cycle for everything. But that's why this study was conducted over 27 years, and that was the first, as it were, whistleblower indicator that we've got some problems. And then my colleagues started to put together the numbers on the different continents and have come up with a similar conclusion that we are missing bugs and insects, and that can't be good.
I got a text. Is if you get hit by one of those bumblebees while you're riding your bike, you need to get checked for concussion because they're lethal. I don't think I've ever seen a bumblebee. Are they really big?
Yeah, they're pretty big. They're maybe the size of maybe half the size of your 50-cent piece. So they're quite large.
Okay.
Not too often will you get bonked by one of them. They're very docile. They're gentle. And oddly, they do not sting very often. Their stinger, Trevor, is not barbed. In other words, she can sting you more than once. In the honeybee, it's a barbed stinger, and when she stings you, it rips out of her abdomen and she dies.
Okay.
So it's really a last-ditch effort. Bees don't go around and sting people for the fun of it.
Good morning, Hugh.
I live in northwest New South Wales and frequently have to go to Queensland, Brisbane, Canberra, Sydney. And I've noticed over the last 10 years a massive decline in insects on your windscreens. For instance, I've just been down to Canberra and back, not one insect. Now, this has been happening for the last 10 years and I'm becoming a little bit alarmed, because if we have a collapse in our insects, and as Rhys has alluded to, that's perhaps more troublesome than worrying about CO2 and other things, because that's the whole ecosystem that everything depends upon.
The thing is, though, Hugh, isn't the if we that's the CO2 levels and all of those things are all intertwined.
Yeah. Well, that's true. It is all intertwined, but something's causing, and I've read all the articles of the studies in Germany, but it's happening in North America. It's worldwide, and I think we should be becoming a little bit alarmed about what's happening.
Okay, and I guess that's one of the things that came up in this article from the ABC, which is one of the reasons that we're talking to Reece about it, is that, yes, it is alarming, but Reece, it's not as if it's anything new necessarily, and we've been informed by scientists for a very long time that if we don't take a look at what we do with the environment, what we put into the environment, whether it be CO2 levels, whether it be insecticides, whether it be how we clear the land, if we don't look at it closely, we're going to have problems.
Yeah, well, you're not wrong. So the bigger question is, how do we mere mortals on Main Street attack this? Do we wait? In America, we call our government Big Brother. Do we wait for Big Brother to bring in a policy that says thou shalt? Or do we take matters into our own hands? I am of the opinion, Trevor, that there are millions of people on planet Earth who have taken matters into their own hands by consuming less, by becoming compassionate. The single biggest thing that each of us can do, and I know I've told you this before, is to switch our diet to a plant-based diet. It's healthy, it's water smart, it's compassionate, and the animal agriculture contributes more heat-trapping greenhouse gases than all of our global transportation. But that's just one thing. I mean, there are so many things. But I guess the most difficult thing for our listeners and our fellow humans to understand is the only constant in life is change. Change is opportunity in disguise. And again, I go back to being thrifty. When we become thrifty, when we waste far less, we become happier. Because the cool thing is about being human, is we're lifelong learners. How many listeners will be nodding their head right now? They love to tinker. We're tinkerers by design. And I suggest that by tinkering and by consuming less, we have a fighting chance. I will suggest this. If we do nothing, it will be analogous to the cartoon of the man or woman walking down the pathway, hitting a rake and getting the rake straight between the eyes. And it's not a good ending that way.
Reece, the thing is, though, we've had many people involved in town planning on the program over the last little while talking about how to make cities better, how to recognise mm-hmm. the road systems and how what to do. And each one has said to me that we know exactly what to do, how to make cities better. We know exactly what to do about road systems. We know exactly what to do as far as public transport is concerned, but governments won't listen to us.
Well,
and so that seems to be one of the issues, is that there are plenty of people that know what to do, but governments don't do it.
Well, you know what? Then that's voter apathy, because here's the thing. So far that I'm aware of, we live in a democracy, some of our countries. We vote the governments out of power who are not representing the people. Why are many governments, why do they strictly represent the oligarchs, the oil people? There's two other things, Trevor, very quickly. One is globally, the audience needs to understand that all of our countries are handing fossil fuels $5.3 trillion a year to kill and cook our planet. And number two, the second thing that each of us can do is divest from our fossil fuel holdings, whether that's in your superannuation or whether it's in your personal stock portfolio. It's a wonderful movement. It has gone from $3 trillion to $6 trillion in the last 18 months. And reinvest those monies in the renewables. The renewables give healthy rates of return. There's lots of things we can do, Trev.
Good on you, Reece. It's always good to talk to you.
Cheers, mate.